Welcome to season 3 of the Fit Farming Food Mom podcast. I am Connie Nightingale, a former bodybuilder, certified personal trainer and nutritionist with an extreme passion for functional health and fitness. There is a huge problem these days with the standard health narrative. The current allopathic medicine, fitness theories, and nutrition guidelines are completely missing the mark. Through this podcast, I have been able to get uncensored, unfiltered knowledge out to the masses to help anyone. No matter if you're an average Joe or an elite athlete, I want to provide you with valuable knowledge to help you achieve your health and fitness goals. Remember, the best way to support this podcast is leaving a review on Apple Podcasts or iTunes and sharing with your friends and family or tagging me in your stories or posts on social media. Let's get this health movement out to others. Thank you so much again for joining me. Now let's get to the show. Hey friends, welcome back to another episode. I hope you had an awesome 4th, had a great holiday, and were able to spend some time relaxing or spending time with your friends and family. I know I did. We went camping, got rained out, thunder and lightning, all the fun things. I was really just hoping that a tree wasn't going to fall on our tent. I'm pretty much an outdoors girl, but the wind was blowing pretty crazy and there was branches crashing all around us. And I was thinking, you know, this is not a real convenient time to be in a tent. Other than that, we had a couple of great warm days, spent some time in the river in the middle of nowhere, unplugged from everything, no cell phones, no Wi-Fi, no work, which seems to be something that I do a lot of these days. And so it was really great to get away from that and just unplug and hang with my family. One thing I noticed is my sleep is fantastic when I sleep in a tent and when I'm away from electronics for the day. I'm out in there, I'm getting natural sunlight, and then I sleep amazing. Every single night, my Oura Ring said my recovery scores were 91, 99. My sleep was 91, 99. It was all in the high ranges. So that was really, really exciting. So I do love that tangible data that I can get from just being outside, knowing that it is definitely good for my health and good for my mental state and good for my sleep. So that's just a friendly reminder. Get out there, get sunlight, get time away from your phone at night so that you can unwind and get some good quality sleep. Anyhow, today I am so excited to have Dr. Alexis Cowan coming on the podcast. She is a Princeton-trained PhD in molecular biology, and she specializes in leveraging the interplay between nutrition and metabolism. And today we have an awesome conversation kind of about everything because she had a big weight loss journey, much like myself. So we talk about looking back, what she did wrong with that journey, and also what it allowed her to learn along the way so she can help other people. We also talk about protein metabolism and all of the good things. I'm really excited for this podcast. Anyway, before we get going, I do want to remind you there is still grapefruit LMNT. It is the best flavor ever. I just ran out and I'm hoping I can get some more here in the next few days. But anyway, if you want to try it out, www.drinklmnt.com/Connie will get you a free sample pack. Highly recommend getting that grapefruit coming before it is all gone. So far it's hanging on, but I don't know how much longer that will be. It is very, very popular. Before I ramble on too much more, here is my podcast with Dr. Alexis Cowan. All right, Alexis, I am super excited to have you on the show. Our mutual friend Joel Green said, hey, you've got to have this girl on the podcast. She is so similar to you and your story. And so I was like, yeah, let's do it.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm so happy to be here. Joel's a great friend, and I'm sure we're going to have an awesome conversation.
Well, so as with every podcast episode that I do, I usually start out by just having you tell my listeners who you are, what you do, what got you going in this direction that you're going.
Cool. Yeah. So my name is Alexis Cowan. I'm a PhD in molecular biology from Princeton. And my research focus there wasn't actually in molecular biology. It was in metabolism and specifically in understanding how different nutritional inputs and exercise modalities affect metabolism. Specifically, I focused a lot on ketogenic diet and fasting and how that, you know, impacts each unique tissue in the body, and then how that comes together to shape changes in whole body metabolism as well. my journey to Princeton was kind of maybe atypical. Like, I didn't even know anything about graduate school for most of my life up until maybe junior year of undergrad, when my advisor — I went to a small school called Moravian College in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania — and my advisor there, he had went to Yale and he also did a postdoc, and he was telling me that he thinks I would be a great fit for academia. And I looked into it and I found out that you actually get paid to go to grad school, at least in the sciences and some other fields as well, which I thought, you know, that's a pretty sweet deal. I get paid to go do research. They give you health benefits. So it seemed like a no-brainer. I also, that summer after he had told me that, he helped me get into a program through the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, which basically had me do like a mock grad school for a summer at Duke. So I got to do research. I got to look, like, see what it looked like to be in a lab every day, and what it looked like to collect data, analyze data, and present it to my peers. And it was overall a great experience. And so I ended up applying to graduate school. I actually took a gap year because I didn't get into the programs that I was really looking to get into my first year. In my gap year, I was at Bristol-Myers Squibb, which is a pharmaceutical company, doing some work there with understanding how to optimize antibody production for anti-cancer therapies. And then I ended up getting accepted into Princeton, which was a great fit for me because I'm from New Jersey. I wanted somewhere that was close, that wouldn't necessarily interfere with my personal life too much, because I could commute there and, you know, also still get obviously a great education. But I should backtrack and say how I got even interested in science in general, which wasn't necessarily always an affinity of mine. I was always a very curious person. But science, you know, never really stuck out to me, though I wouldn't say that's too much of a surprise given the state of our primary and secondary education system. It doesn't really market it in a very fun way, I would say. And so I was overweight most of my life, actually obese, we would say. So I maxed out around like 270, and I'm about 5'9" for reference. And so, you know, I was kind of sick of living that life because I was also, you know, sick pretty frequently. I would get respiratory infections, you know, a couple times a year, I would say. And so, you know, I one day basically decided that I didn't want to live like that anymore, and, you know, got a gym membership and started tracking my food. And about a year later, I was down about 85 pounds. And then from there, lost an additional 15 over the course of the following year. And that was through the combination of food tracking, cardio exercise, and resistance training. And then after that, as many people do, I felt that I developed some sort of disordered eating pattern from tracking calories for so long and being so strict about food and not really seeing food as nourishment, but seeing it just as like a means to an end, which is hard for me because I'm a major foodie and I always have been. I love food. I love cooking. I love eating. So it really was harmful, I would say, to my well-being to have that sort of relationship with my diet. And on top of that, I had also developed IBS a couple of years after losing the weight, probably through a combination of weight loss, which we know can, like, extreme weight loss can damage the gut over time, unless you're taking the proper steps to kind of mitigate those effects. That plus like disordered eating, it was bulimia specifically. So that obviously is going to wreak havoc on the gut. So I decided to kind of take matters into my own hands. The doctors weren't really helping me. They were saying I was young, like it'll probably just pass. Meanwhile, you know, I'm suffering daily with terrible bloating and like GI bleeding and all of that. So I identified my trigger foods by doing an elimination diet essentially, and found dairy to be a major trigger for me. I ended up cutting it out for about 3 years. During that time, I also was basically switching to a whole foods based diet. So eating mostly very fresh local animal foods and like seasonal local produce. And that really like changed the game for me because I could now feel like I can eat to be satisfied and I don't have to worry about over consuming because of my body's naturally going to regulate its appetite in accordance with the nutrients coming in, not like these very highly processed foods that kind of hijack our reward system and prevent us from feeling that satiety signal from what we're eating. So that really allowed me to maintain my weight loss without feeling the guilt around eating, and ultimately allowed me to move on past my disordered eating problems and body dysmorphia to a certain extent too, which the resistance training also helped a lot in that aspect, because it really allows you to like shape your body and sculpt it in a way that just losing weight isn't going to necessarily do. So those things, and then in conjunction with that later, actually about 2 years into my time at Princeton, I found Joel Green's work and the immunity code and his gut protocol. And I hopped on that, was on it for about 6 months, tried reintroducing dairy, had zero problems, introduced more dairy and some like raw vegetables, which would have caused me bloating, like terrible bloating in the past, had zero problems. And now basically I eat whatever I want, whenever I want, and I'd never have any sort of GI discomfort. It's been like that for a couple of years now, at least. So it's really been a long journey of understanding my body through both like a personal empirical lens and then also through a scientific lens through my studies and research at school that have allowed me to come to a really good place in my own life where I feel like I'm working with my body instead of against it, and then ultimately trying to help other people do the same thing.
I love that. So at what point in your journey did you start working towards the PhD?
Okay. So I started at Princeton in 2016. This was after I had cut out dairy completely. My IBS symptoms were basically in remission at that point from removing the dairy. I would still get occasional bloating from just eating like raw veg and stuff like that. So, but there was nothing too crazy. So I had maintained the weight loss. This was like post eating disorder as well. So I was on like a very like clean diet, you could say. And that's when I started the PhD program and really diving into more of like the strategies to help me prevent any sort of flare-ups or discomfort. And then stumbling upon Joel's work probably in 2019. So about 3 years into my PhD.
I was just curious because I know a lot of us, our mess becomes our message, right? And given the subject that you chose, I was like, how much of your previous journey impacted the subject that you chose?
Yeah, it's really interesting, actually. So when I came to Princeton, I didn't have any idea of the labs there. Like a lot of people would choose Princeton because they're targeting a certain lab or a certain research topic. And I basically went to Princeton because it was convenient and close, which is just like a happy accident, really. And then I figured, I mean, how bad could it be? Like, I'm sure there's great lab choices. I'm going to be fine. But then I actually ended up struggling to find a lab and thinking that I might have to drop out. But ultimately finding in my last rotation, because there's basically three rotations in the department that I was in. So you try out three different labs, essentially. And then your favorite one you'll pick to be your home lab for the rest of the 4 to 5 years that you're there. So in my last rotation, I went into the Rabinowitz lab, which is where I ended up choosing. And I was like super depressed going into that rotation because I thought, you know, this is the last chance I have. If I don't like this, like I'm done. And my first day was just, I was paired with a postdoc to mentor me. And it was just a perfect match. Like, he was such a godsend. He has a lab now at UC Irvine. His name is Chulsoon Young. And he, you know, was very big on like BCAA metabolism and studying diabetes. And just a very passionate and fun person, and like couldn't ask for a better mentor. And really, like from the first day that I was shadowing him, I knew like this was going to be a perfect fit, especially when I found out that how much like nutritional and exercise research was up and coming and ongoing there. It never occurred to me that I could, you know, marry my personal interests and my professional endeavors, but that really clicked at that moment. And that's when I decided to go down that path.
Okay. So I love this. This is awesome. Now, let's kind of revisit some things, because I think you have a lot of important things to get out there. And so your journey was like a lot of people's journeys when it comes to weight loss, right? Let's exercise a lot and let's cut our calories. Now, luckily you were successful with that, but how many people aren't, right? Because they they can only go for so long before our primal instincts take over and they're like, okay, wait a minute, you're hungry. Or you get that restrictive mindset where you have to restrict and then you binge because you restrict so long. I mean, there's so many different deep levels to this and layers, but I kind of want to revisit this a little bit because now that you know, and you went through all of this, it helps you tell your story so that people can lose weight in a better fashion, I would imagine.
Absolutely. Yeah, there, I would definitely not recommend, even though it worked for me, I would say there's a better way to do it that's not going to like damage your relationship with your body, mm-hmm. To that extent. So obviously we know we need to be in a caloric deficit, but how we get there can be, you know, can occur in many ways. And the best way to do that is to, you know, not eat processed foods, which I would say at the time I was eating a lot of processed foods because they're easy to count calories. Like, mm-hmm. you know, it says how many macros and calories are in, you know, whatever you're eating right mm-hmm. on the box. So it's very easy to do the math. You know, when you're eating whole foods, you're doing more weighing and measuring, but in the long term, it's going to help a lot more because your appetite's going to be better regulated. You're not going to feel the need to binge as much, especially if you're prioritizing protein in the diet, mm-hmm. which is likely the most satisfying and satiating macronutrient that we could eat. Mm-hmm. The amino acids from the protein send very strong signals to the brain to basically, you know, let us know that we're eating something that's very nutrient dense, and then we'll have to basically eat less to feel full. So prioritizing protein would be a first huge step towards that. And then really trying to maybe avoid starchy carbs, at least in the beginning, depending on the person, just because if you get those big glucose swings, depending on their level of insulin sensitivity, you know, that can also drive hunger and appetite. So trying to maintain stable blood glucose levels pretty constantly is a good strategy also to, you know, making your appetite and your body work with you instead of against you. Mm-hmm. And then also, I think there's some, like cardio is obviously a tool for getting into a calorie deficit more easily. But I personally think that prioritizing weight training will be more of an ally, just because you're going to be maintaining your muscle mass through a calorie deficit, which your muscle is a major metabolic organ. So it's responsible for a great deal of your metabolic rate. And if you're just doing cardio and in a caloric deficit, then you're going to be losing lean mass as well, which includes your muscle mass. And then that leads to a decreased metabolic rate, which can ultimately make it harder to stay in a caloric deficit and keep losing weight. So by prioritizing resistance training, we can maintain more of that really very important muscle mass. And then kind of that helps us to maintain a caloric deficit throughout the weight loss journey. And you're also burning calories while you're lifting weights, of course. So something that's like, I think floating around on the internet, it's like, if you want to do cardio, lift weights faster, but essentially that works. Like your heart rate can get up to, you know, 170, 180 easily during a heavy lift. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like a natural style of interval training. Mm-hmm. And then you're getting the added bonus of retaining muscle mass and even maybe putting on a little bit of muscle mass. If you're a newbie to training, you can even put on some muscle while you're losing fat and in a caloric deficit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's one of my favorite things about strength training is I tell people all the time, I'm like, listen, cardio is not giving you that extra resource. The more muscle you have, the better your insulin sensitivity is going to be, the more calories you are going to burn just sitting still doing nothing. You and I are burning some calories while we're having this conversation because yep. we have done what it takes to have a higher lean body mass. So that's all really, really important things to focus on, I think.
Yep, absolutely. And you know, at the beginning, people might see, it depends on what their goals are, but if you're optimizing for fat loss, you know, you might see a little bit of muscle gain if you've never done resistance training before. But ultimately that will taper off. And like, ultimately in the long term, gains come over 5, 10+ years. And like, I've been lifting for 12 years now and, you know, body composition can happen kind of slowly over that term. If you're not, you know, wanting to be in a caloric surplus, to put on muscle mass, it can happen more gradually. Of course, you can optimize for muscle gain by making sure that you're overfeeding. So like eating more than your basal caloric needs, especially prioritizing protein. Again, I think prioritizing protein all around is a great idea for anybody's goals. But that's not to say there's also not a place for fasting or eating, you know, even a vegan diet for short periods of time to get to use like as a specific tool. For whatever your needs may be. Like in some spiritual practices, they eat a vegan diet to help them tap into their own intuitions and like their own bodies more. And I think there's research emerging in that area too, like dietary manipulation to kind of get specific outcomes. You know, we don't always have to eat the same thing. And that's also where intuitive eating comes in, where it's like you're listening to what your body wants and then going from there. But you can't really start to do that until you get all the processed stuff out of your diet, because that's hijacking your ability to kind of interpret what your body actually wants.
Mm-hmm. I love that you bring this up, because it's something that I hit on hard all the time, especially where you said back there, you're like, when somebody's initially starting their fat loss journey, they're going to have those blood sugar swings and stuff, more than likely because they have been eating these hyper palatable foods. And what are these hyper palatable foods? Well, they're almost never protein, right? They're almost, exactly. They're almost always like high carbohydrate typically, and some unhealthy fats for the most part. And these things literally get us to where we feel out of control, and it makes it hard to start a health journey because all of our actual normal signals have been completely hijacked.
Absolutely. So even a first step before, like if somebody wants to lose weight, maybe before they even start cutting calories, they can just start gradually shifting their diet to include more whole foods like meats and vegetables, and just eliminating the processed drinks, carbs, like processed foods, and just allowing themselves to really get in touch with their natural rhythms, how they feel in response to different foods, and then kind of transitioning into a caloric deficit and allowing that to happen in a more regulated way, in a way that feels healthier and doesn't feel like as much of a roller coaster ride.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And revisiting the protein thing. So, I mean, obviously there are different kinds of proteins, and in your study, you probably learned about like the different amino acids and how they affect us. And that's another thing that I have found that has become very, very common is people start counting macros, but you know, you get all of these protein sources or these amino acid sources from things that may not necessarily be something that our body can absorb because we're missing other pieces of the puzzle. Can you elaborate on any of that stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. So protein isn't a simple, you know, equation necessarily. Protein is kind of diverse depending on the source you're getting it from. For example, you know, most plant proteins aren't complete proteins. There are exceptions like hemp, I think is one actually that has all the amino acids that we need. But for most plant protein sources, you have to combine multiple plants together in order to get a full complete amino acid profile, which means that it contains all of the essential amino acids. And the essential amino acids are the ones that our body can't synthesize itself. And so we need to get these through the diet in order to maintain the protein pools in our body, which include, you know, not only muscle, but all of the functions of different proteins in our body, like enzymes and you know, receptors and everything that our body needs to make out of amino acids will require essential amino acids. So if you're eating an animal protein source, typically that means that you're going to be getting all of the essential amino acids. There are exceptions, like collagen is actually not a source of the essential amino acids. It has its other benefits, mm-hmm. which we can definitely talk about. But if you're eating a skeletal muscle or even something like liver or heart, you're going to be getting all of the essential amino acids there. Whereas a plant protein, maybe you would have to pair something like rice with beans in order to get all of the like specifically lysine and other essential amino acids that you will need in order to get the proper muscle protein synthesis stimuli, mm-hmm. and then also just supporting your protein pools in general. Mm-hmm. So that's one side of the equation for sure. And then, you know, ultimately muscle, if you're eating skeletal muscle, it's going to have a more satiating effect than a plant protein just because the protein biomass is so much higher. So if you're eating a steak, it's, you know, largely composed of protein and water versus, you know, eating something like rice, which is vastly composed of carbohydrate with a small amount of protein. So the amount of volume and calories you need to eat to get the same amount of protein is vastly different between something like rice and something like steak. So if you're on a calorie, trying to get into calorie deficit or lose weight, then, you know, it makes way more sense to prioritize animal meat and protein just because you're getting so much more bang for your buck.
Absolutely. I love that. And that's another reason why not just anybody can coach people that want to be vegan. I explain that there are so many people out there that, oh yeah, I can do a vegan meal plan. Well, but can you really? Because anybody can plug things into MyFitnessPal and be like, okay, that's 100 grams of protein, but is it 100 grams of complete proteins and all the essential amino acids? There is a big, huge difference. So, yeah, vegan's real tough anyways. I personally don't ever steer anybody that way, but there are people that have beliefs that go along with that and whatnot. And, there are coaches out there that are good at coaching it. I wouldn't be one of them. I try to stay away from that, but if you are somebody that leans towards that, which I am not by any means, saying that it's the way to go, but I'm saying if you're somebody out there that has considered it, you need to make sure that you're getting all of those essential amino acids, because if you're not, then you're not going to have what you need in order for your body to do its thing.
Yep. I would say it's almost impossible to, you know, have a healthy body composition on a vegan diet unless you're supplementing with protein powder. You know, and that is possible in this day and age. But again, I don't think it's necessarily the healthiest route, because you're also not getting a lot of the micronutrients, cofactors, et cetera, that you will get from an animal food, in a plant protein powder. And ultimately protein powders are processed foods. So that is something to consider when taking them in. It should be an add-on. It should be an add-on to your diet, not necessarily a staple of the diet, which it kind of has to be in a modern vegan diet. You can probably get around it, but it's going to be very tricky. For sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Not to mention you're just going to be a whole lot hungrier if you're approaching a diet that way. So I try to, with anybody that I work with, I tell them prioritize protein. Sometimes it may not be optimal, right? Sometimes it might be, I don't know, I'm trying to think of an example, like maybe it is a protein bar or more, there are some cleaner ones and some dirtier ones out there. But I mean, any kind of processed bar to me is really not what I would like to do, but I look for the better ones. I'm like, okay, what's got better ingredients here? What has better protein? And I'm always looking at, if it does have a label, how much protein is in it, prioritize that protein. So if you're eating out somewhere and you don't want to just eat a bunch of garbage, look for the most protein dense thing that you can find on the menu.
Yep. Basically anywhere you go, you can probably find a chicken breast and some steamed vegetables, and that can kind of be in alignment with whatever your goals are. I mean, yeah, I agree. Like I can't remember the last time I ate fast food, honestly, but some people feel like it's maybe their only option. And yeah, it's probably best in the beginning to switch to healthier options at the places that you're comfortable going, and then gradually shifting away to making more food at home. You know, people don't have time, and at the same time, people do have time. It's just a matter of where they're prioritizing it. And if you do meal prep, you know, it can take an hour of your time on a weekend, and then you have food for the week. So it's really a matter of like being organized and planning ahead. And then it's really, there's not an excuse to, you know, go to McDonald's or go wherever you would typically go to get fast food when you already have that food available to you. Just having healthy options around.
Yeah. Well, so I want to switch gears here. And so in your journey, you said that you got really into the gut microbiome and how important it was and how it works. And if anybody knows me, they know I preach gut health like crazy. And I feel like it rules the world when it comes to our overall big picture of health. So I want to talk about a little bit about what you have learned in your journey about the gut microbiome.
Yeah. So I love this topic. I'm actually working as the scientific content director for Layer Origin, which, if you're familiar with them, they're kind of an up and coming company in the gut health optimization space. They make some human milk oligosaccharides, HMOs, that were initially maybe popularized by Joel's book. But we can talk about those, that they're like highly, they're highly important for the development of specific strains and species of bacteria in the gut. That are called bifidobacteria. And these bacteria are very crucial to gut health for multiple reasons, but essentially their importance starts out in the infant gut. And breast milk is composed of lots of different human milk oligosaccharides, and all of which will feed bifidobacteria to the point where it's like 90% of the bacteria in the infant gut are bifidobacteria. And then over time, those populations begin to dwindle. And actually, if you look at people who aren't aging healthfully, so they're having a lot of comorbidities, and people who have healthy aging process, you can see basically across the board that the people aging more healthfully will have higher levels of bifidobacteria in the gut. So they're closely tied with healthy aging process, as well as avoiding diseases, and just ultimately like a better quality of life in general. And so there are different tools that we can use to optimize bifidobacteria levels in the gut throughout the aging process. And those include both supplements and foods. So HMO powder that like lay origin cells and like Joel talks about in his gut protocol in his book, is a great strategy to enhance bifidobacteria. They love to eat this stuff. Basically what it is, it's a polysaccharide, which means that it's like multiple sugar molecules bound together, but it's unique in that our digestive system can't digest it. So what it does is it basically passes through the stomach, the small intestine, and can reach to the colon where most of the gut microbiome resides. And it can support bifidobacteria levels there. And in addition to that, things that are foods that are polyphenol rich, like dark fruits and like brightly colored vegetables and fruits, you can essentially think of those as being polyphenol rich. Those molecules will also feed bifidobacteria. And by supporting levels of bifido in the gut, we're essentially going to get an indirect boost in the production of butyrate, which is a short-chained fatty acid. So these are basically 2 to 4 carbons long, these short-chain fatty acids. The major ones are acetate, propionate, and butyrate. And bifidobacteria themselves produce acetate, and they also produce another molecule called lactate, which is also produced in our body by our own cells, but bifidobacteria also makes them. And this acetate and lactate can go on to feed the bacteria that produce butyrate in the gut. They're also known as like butyrogenic bacteria. So by supporting the butyrogenic bacteria, we get boosted levels of butyrate, which is crucial because not only is butyrate the major fuel source for colon cells, but it also is highly immunomodulatory, which means that it can kind of change the way our immune system is working, and push it towards a more anti-inflammatory state. So for people that are dealing with any sort of chronic inflammatory diseases, like any autoimmune disease, arthritis, even obesity, which is tightly associated with inflammation, diabetes as well. By prioritizing foods and or supplements that can boost bifidobacteria, you can then go on to boost butyrate levels, which can modulate the immune system to help spin down that inflammation that's created in those chronic disease settings. And that ultimately that can help to, you know, ameliorate these conditions, provide symptom relief, and ultimately getting to the root cause of the issue, which is these inflammatory drivers that are coming from leaky gut, which, you know, there's like food antigens and also like bacterial molecules that can get through the gut that aren't supposed to, that trigger off inflammation. And that can ultimately help to seal the gut. And then, you know, which is like getting to the root of the issue, preventing further inflammation, allowing the current inflammation to come down, and really seeing some major like actual benefits that people can feel, not just on paper or on blood work.
Mm-hmm. And I want to revisit something you said there, because you were talking about the colorful fruits and veggies and dark fruits and things. One thing we have to keep in mind is what's the impact of not eating some of these organic with our gut microbiome? Mm.
Totally. So, I mean, glyphosate is a major contaminant, and other pesticides, herbicides, fungicides that are sprayed onto conventional produce. Basically anything that can harm bacteria is going to be harming us. And I think the mainstream is really just coming to this realization that, you know, we may not be able to see the bacteria that live in and on us, but they are very much there. And there's actually more of them than there are us within us. So we need to consider that anything that is harmful to them is also harming us. And I think over time, we're hopefully, like, we need to see a gradual shift in the use of these compounds to things that are more life affirmative, and things that aren't going to be damaging our microbiome, which consists of bacteria, fungi, and viruses. Like, they're all an integral part of our bodies. They're not things that we need to kill and kill off and be without, which mm-hmm. was like the whole era of like sterilization and even just going into a hospital. Like a sterile environment's not natural, and you can kind of sense that when you're in a hospital. Like nobody wants to be there. It doesn't feel natural. It's not really a place for healing, which is its whole other can of worms and a problem in itself. But organic produce is super important, because especially for certain fruits and veggies, like apples are notoriously sprayed with pesticides, and those residues will be present. Even if you're going to be soaking and washing them, they could be still embedded in the fruit. So I personally try to buy organic and local when possible, just because you're getting more nutrient dense, fresh food if you're buying local. And then also the organic side of things, you're not going to be exposed to as many of those pesticide residues that, you know, are going to be compromising the integrity of your gut and your microbiome.
Mm-hmm. So I have a question with that. I know I personally, sometimes it's more affordable to buy organic frozen vegetables. It's not optimal because mm-hmm. they're not necessarily fresh, but I feel like when you weigh the things out, if you are able to do one or the other, that could be a good option for people.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, usually when things are frozen, they're picked when they're, you know, fresh and ripe, and then they're frozen almost immediately. So a lot of those nutrients are going to be retained for sure. Of course, like you'll lose some micronutrients just from that freezing process, and like they will degrade naturally, or, you know, the actual freezing process can break those down, but not to the extent where I would say, you know, that not eating them is better than eating them. I'd still say that getting them frozen is better than not having them at all.
Mm-hmm. And then how do you feel about like the clean 15 list and do you think that that's a great thing to go by when it comes to sourcing what veggies to and fruits to prioritize when buying organic or not?
It's something that I've definitely referenced in the past. I would say, you know, just people should just do what they can. It might be a good, you know, template to follow at first, but ultimately, you know, if you can buy organic, if you can afford to, and you have access to it, then you're not only supporting your own health, but the health of the planet. And if you're buying local, you know, that's also supporting your local economy and reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And, you know, I think that's really the direction that we need to go as a society if we're actually worried about and trying to slow down the degradation of our planet. There's a big focus on not eating meat as the answer, which is just silly in my opinion, because it's basically a scapegoat for, you know, the people who are doing most of the damage to not have to take responsibility for it.
Mm-hmm.
But we can all take responsibility in our own lives by just trying to buy things that are supporting our local economy, haven't been transported halfway across the world for us to eat, and really just prioritizing those foods over the others. And, you know, that can make a big impact over time. And you're also getting more nutrients out of it. So it's a win-win.
Mm-hmm. I love that. Well, if there was anything you wanted to get out there on this podcast today, out of all of your life's journey and all these things that you've learned along the way, what would it be?
That's a good question. I'd say that the main thing that I would love to emphasize with people is just that you can and should take responsibility for your body and your health, and no doctor or professional is ever going to know your body as well as you do. And it's really about tapping back into the messages your body is sending you and not ignoring them. Or, you know, there's a time and place for doctors, but sometimes like the answer is pretty clear and you know what's causing you harm and pain, and then you should just do something about that instead of trying to numb it or you know, ignore it. So I think that's a major step that everybody should take in just kind of reclaiming their health and just making an honest effort to doing the best that you can with the information that you have and the resources that you have. I think it can be paralyzing for some people. It's like there's a lot of information out there. You don't know what's true. And I think especially with COVID, that really came to light where, you know, there was a lot of conflicting opinions. People with very valid opinions were being censored. And, you know, I think it really exposed a lot of the hypocrisy and also like bureaucracy behind how we're getting information to the public. And so really just trying to find people that you trust in the health space, you know, asking really good questions, not being afraid to ask questions. Like there's no real experts in the world. We're all just learning. Mm-hmm. You know, science is not settled in any field, no matter what anybody tells you. Like, ask questions. If something doesn't make sense, ask it. Try your best to learn and grow and not get stuck in a certain way of being, and just be open to change, open to learning, and just taking everything day by day. You know, progress isn't linear. There's going to be ups and downs, but just doing our best every day is all we can really do.
Yeah, I love that. And I think that this society definitely gets hung up on Western medicine and what they have to say. And I think that they need to realize there are people out there that have just as much knowledge, if not more, sometimes when it comes to the health space. And they may not necessarily have an MD or a DR or anything involved with their name. So also getting kind of off of that sticking point where they think that traditional Western medicine is the do all and end all to getting you to where your health needs to be.
Oh yeah, totally. And I mean, Western medicine has its place, and especially in trauma care, like keeping you alive, like in a pinch, it's great for that. But for giving you a good life and, you know, a life that you feel good about and you're not suffering during is a whole nother story. And our system's not really equipped to handle that. So if you're trying to optimize your health and avoid disease, you need an entirely different system. And there are people out there like you and I and Joel and many other doctors and health practitioners in the space who our goal is really to do that. I think I can speak for all of us to say that we want to help people live better, not just to live, not just survival, but thriving.
Right. Absolutely. Well, awesome. I have loved having you on the show. If my listeners want to come find you, how do they do that?
Yep. So it's been really fun. We should do it again. I'm on Instagram at Dr. Alexis Jasmine. My website is www.dralexisjasmine.com. I'm currently taking some one-on-one people for, you know, kind of health coaching and nutrition optimization, but I'm switching more to working with like coaches and medical practitioners instead. But you know, for highly motivated individuals, I would be, you know, potentially interested in working with you if you're interested. And then any sort of coaches and medical practitioners that are looking to develop and implement protocols for especially gut optimization and fat loss, I am happy to work with you. I'm going to be launching a program probably this summer, a container for coaches to kind of get access to protocols like this that they can use with their clients. So I'll be excited to see how that goes. And thank you so much for having me.
Well, you're doing some great things. Keep up the good work. I love that you're getting information out there too for coaches and things. That's totally awesome.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for tuning in. For further information about me and my programs, as well as free recipes and other health tips, please visit www.ConnieNightingale.com or find me on Instagram at ConnieBegani. I want to remind you that any opinions or views expressed in this podcast are their own and that they are not intended to diagnose, treat, or cure any illness or condition. This show is not intended to replace your regular health care. Please consult with your current primary care provider before changing any of your diet, exercise, or medical protocols. Thanks so much for tuning in. See you next time.